This is not about picking a winner. This is about getting gas to Alaskans.
A new push for an in-state gas line. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Bering Sea ice pack is moving south rapidly, disrupting the crab season.
Pretty much every year, there's, you know, an ice adventure of some sort.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Buccaneer Alaska is nearing its goal of bringing a jackup rig into Cook Inlet later this year to join a rig owned by Escapeta Oil and Gas Company that arrived last year. But where will the rig be stored during the winter months? One plan is for the 300-foot-tall rig to be docked at the harbor near the end of Homer Spit. As KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports, the plan is already drawing controversy in Homer.
Are people in Homer dead set against Alaska's oil and gas industry?
There's a generalized perception that the entire Homer area is in opposition to any oil and gas development.
That's Homer Representative Paul Seaton speaking before the Homer City Council January 9th. Seaton says that perception about Homer, whether it's true or not, has been a hurdle in attempts to secure state funding for the South Peninsula Pipeline, a $10 million project that would bring natural gas into the Homer area for the first time. Seaton says there is something tangible, however, that the community could do to affirm its support for Cook Inlet oil and gas development. Allow Buccaneer Alaska to dock its 300-foot-tall jackup rig at the Homer Harbor next winter. Homer City Manager Walt Reedy says it is definitely a possibility that Buccaneer's rig and perhaps even the other Cook Inlet jackup rig owned by Escapeta Oil and Gas Company could tie up at the Homer Harbor next winter.
They have both contacted us to inquire about whether or not they could tie up to the dock in Homer. But right now there aren't any definite plans with either one.
Escapeta's jackup rig began production in Cook Inlet last year and is presently moored near Port Graham with its 300-foot-tall legs extended down to the ocean floor. Seaton says that because of the presence of the Escapeta rig, the Port Graham area is seeing an economic boon to the tune of $4 million. Reedy says the moorage fees alone for a ship that size through a four-month period would be in the neighborhood of $150,000. That's not including other economic impacts of hosting the rig on the Homer Spit.
I can't put a price tag on it, but there would definitely be some jobs.
It's really important to emphasize local hire on these things because we've seen time and time again they'll bring up workers from the lower 48 and, they'll pop them into their community and they'll pull them out when the rig is gone and when the project's over. So it's really important to invest in the local community.
That's Bob Shavelson of the Homer-based environmental watchdog group Cook Inlet Keeper. He points to the fact that oil and gas rigs have been banned in Ketchumak Bay since 1976. That's the year the oil rig George Ferris became stuck in Mud Bay and caused considerable public outcry. In addition to environmental and labor concerns, Shavelson wonders about Homer's world-famous view of Ketchumak Bay.
Anybody that's paying higher taxes for their view property on the bluff and has a beautiful view of the Homer Spit better know that there's the potential that view is going to change dramatically.
Shavelson advises the city to go through a public process before signing off on any agreement with Buccaneer. Officials from Buccaneer Alaska declined to comment directly for this story. The company's PR firm, JMR Worldwide, said in an email that, quote, all options are still being considered and no decisions have been made as of yet. Buccaneer's jackup rig is currently being outfitted in Singapore for duty in Cook Inlet this summer. In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
State House Speaker Mike Chenault, a Republican from Nikiski, is renewing his push for a small diameter in-state gas line with a new bill that streamlines previous legislation. House Bill 9 combines three bills that passed the House last year, but not the Senate. It gives the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation more funding and more authority to develop a small diameter pipeline that would bring gas to South Central Alaska. He says Alaska's goal should still be a large gas pipeline for export, but the state can't wait indefinitely for that to happen.
This is not about picking a winner. This is about getting gas to Alaskans.
He says allowing the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation to move ahead on a small line will be invaluable, even if a large export project is built. Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker helped Speaker Chenault write the bill. He says the legislation does not compete with the state's framework to build an export gas line, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA.
This legislation allows AGDC to be both compatible and sympathetic with the AGIA project, and we frankly hope all these people come together, start working together, and move the largest possible project forward.
The gas would likely come from the North Slope, but the bill allows flexibility in case a major gas find is discovered in another part of the state. There has been skepticism that an in-state line could provide gas to Alaskans at a reasonable cost. But Hawker says preliminary studies on the price Alaskans would eventually pay are promising.
Those initial tariff estimates were quite viable for getting gas to Alaska. In fact, I think some of us were really quite surprised at how efficient and effectively it appeared this pipeline project could be developed.
The Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation is working within a timeline that would have the first gas flowing in the fall of 2018. A new study describes employment on the North Slope as a roller coaster. In a report to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee today, Jim Calvin, president of the McDowell Group, presented the results of a study ordered by the Senate to determine what factors influence jobs in the oil patch. His research shows a level of jobs that are interrupted by volatile changes based on oil price and national economic factors.
There was a period of time, you know, through 2009 through 2010 when no one seemed to be quite sure what was going on. You hear reports of people losing their jobs on the North Slope. There were employers that were no longer active and weren't sure why. On the other hand, you'd hear reports of no, employment's growing. It's at the highest level effort. Well, all that was kind of right. It was a very, very dynamic environment.
The report will become part of the record for a bill that would reduce oil company taxes. Original arguments for that measure, sponsored by Governor Parnell, indicated that low oil production was responsible for high rates of unemployment within the industry. The Bering Sea snow crab season is on hold. Rapidly advancing sea ice has left crabbers scrambling to get their gear out of the water or stuck in port waiting for better weather. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has more.
Mark Casto got into port earlier today and is already getting ready to head back out again. He's captain of the crabber Pinnacle. With the ice coming down rapidly, he's worried about the 200 pots he still has in the water.
Just finding them again if you can find them.
Casto says that the ice can drag pots for tens of miles and pop the buoys that keep them afloat. He's hoping he can make it to his pots before they're overtaken by the ice edge.
Just got our fingers crossed we can get back up there in time.
Casto isn't the only one. Fish and Game Area Management Biologist Heather Fitch says there are more than 8,000 snow crab pots out on the fishing grounds right now. They cost at least $1,000 each, so that's more than $8 million worth of gear. And Fitch says almost all of the pots are north of 56.5 degrees. The ice was already at that latitude east of the Pribilof Islands today, and it's forecast to move in quickly to the west. Kathleen Cole is an ice forecaster for the National Weather Service in Anchorage. She says that's unusual.
It's moving across the crab grounds and the cod area. It's moving into where they keep processing ships, and it's big ice. This isn't just, you know, 4 to 6 inch ice that we see often along the ice edge. There is ice thicker than 1.5 feet in some of these flows, and some of the flows coming down are over 15 miles wide.
Cole says the ice is moving in more quickly than usual as well.
In a regular day-to-day ice forecast, the ice might move 2 to 3 miles a day, and here we're having ice movements around 10 miles a day or more. There are some flows that I've watched on satellite imagery that actually have moved 15 to 20 miles in a day.
Cole says the ice edge hit St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs on Monday morning and will probably reach past St. George, 50 miles to the south, by the end of the week. A big part of the snow crab harvest has to be delivered to the Trident processing plant on St. Paul, which isn't possible when the island is surrounded by ice. Trident Council Joe Plesha says boats are still making it into the harbor, but he added that if the ice continues to advance into the fishing grounds, it won't just be St. Paul that isn't processing crab. And the forecast is for it to continue advancing, reaching the outer continental shelf by the weekend. Many crabbers who just finished up the pot cod season last week and hadn't headed out for their first snow crab run are waiting out the ice in Unalaska. Skipper Lance Farr is one of them.
We're not going to go up now in the face of the ice coming down and shutting the season down, the forecast. So we're going to wait. Hopefully, you know, weather changes in a couple weeks and, you know, then we'll start.
He says the biggest problem with waiting is that it pushes back the season and increases expenses. But he added that this isn't the first time this has happened.
One year they even just canceled the whole season, delayed the season for a couple months because the ice had come down so far that there was no grounds to really start on.
Crabber Mark Casto, who's heading north for his pots, says it's all part of being a crab fisherman.
Pretty much every year there's, you know, a nice adventure of some sort.
In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a forecast for extreme northern lights.
I think that it'll be one of these cases where it could be visible most of the night into, you know, into the twilight hours of, I guess, of Wednesday morning.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick, so quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Additional federal charges have been filed against members of a Fairbanks-based militia group. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Anchorage has indicted Peacemakers militia leader Schaefer Cox and members Coleman Barney and Lonnie Vernon on charges of conspiracy to kill federal officers and employees. The offense is punishable by up to life in prison. Cox, Barney, and Vernon already face federal charges for possessing illegal weapons, including grenades, related to their militia activities. State charges against the militia leaders were dropped last fall after it was ruled the state did not have the proper search warrants for use of FBI recordings as evidence. The State Senate opened its Crime Summit today, a series of meetings bringing lawmakers up to date on statistics, trends, and options available to the criminal justice system. In opening the 2 days of meetings, Judiciary Chairman Hollis French asked observers to keep in mind a few basic facts. The state now has more nonviolent prisoners than those who committed violent crimes. The Department of Correction shows the newest prison, Goose Creek in the Mat-Su, cost $238 million to construct, and the average cost of a new high school in the state is $60 million.
That's the good news. The bad news is that DOC tells us that we will be over capacity in 2015, July 2015. We can't just keep building prisons. Ladies and gentlemen, I am still a prosecuting attorney at heart. I was a prosecuting attorney for 6 years. I am perfectly okay with sending deserving individuals to prison for long periods of time, but we ignore these costs at our peril.
French said the purpose of the summit is to explore ways to, quote, bend the line to delay the arrival of that declaration of overcapacity. He said a recent study of Alaska-based criminal system programs showed little balance between program costs and effectiveness.
For example, electronic monitoring systems save lots of money, but they don't keep people from committing new crimes. On the opposite side, sex offender programs do reduce recidivism, but they're so expensive they produce no savings. These are important things you have to keep in mind as you construct responses to a burgeoning prison population.
He said the study did show that Head Start, early childhood education, is one of the options that saves the most money over time and has the longest lasting result. Annie Pinochet, a senior research associate with the Washington State Institute for Public Policy, presented data backing up those studies.
you're 3 years old, you're getting something. You wouldn't think that 20 years later that's changing the course of your life, but the research shows that it really can.
She pointed to studies showing a 20% reduction in crime rates among low-income people who have participated in early education programs. The Federal Subsistence Board last week voted to review the process for deciding a community's rural or non-rural status, which determines eligibility for subsistence priority on federal lands. They also voted to review determinations made using that process. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has the story.
Criteria for rural non-rural determinations include population, economy, social characteristics, and integration with the nearby non-rural community. Almost 5 years ago, the board changed the rural non-rural status of several communities, including Saxman, which it determined to be non-rural, a decision that would have taken effect this coming May. Saxman Tribal Chairman Lee Wallace testified in support of either a stay or reversal of the Saxman non-rural determination.
Some of those criteria should be thrown out, really in common sense. But when you really look at Saxman itself, you know, it's easy to determine that we're a rural village.
Rosemary Tungaruk of the North Slope Subsistence Regional Advisory Council says she had high hopes when she first became involved, but she says the decisions of the board aren't working, and that's hurting people.
Our lands and waters have kept us healthy, safe, and in our homes and in our communities, and that we have gone through continuous efforts to change and expand and make criterias and decisions that have fragmented and changed our maps so that our people can no longer go out into areas and do as their great-grandfather and their grandfathers and their mothers and bring the same information into our children to continue to be who and what we are.
The board is required to review its rural non-rural determinations every 10 years using new census numbers. Last year, the Secretary of Interior also directed the board to review the process by which it makes those determinations. Speaking in support of his motion to launch that review process, BLM State Director Bud Cribley says the public has repeatedly raised concerns about the process.
I just feel based on that, what the public has been information that they have been providing to us, and that we are required to do a review every 10 years, and we are scheduled to start, or we are starting another rural determination review, that we should do a review of that process.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Regional Director Jeff Haskett made the motion to also review rural, non-rural determinations made through that process, saying it will save time if the review leads to new rules. The earlier decisions changing several communities from rural to non-rural are on hold till the review of the larger process is complete. Communities affected by this decision include Prudhoe Bay, Kodiak, Sitka, Point McKenzie, some areas near Homer, and Saxman. Both measures passed unanimously. Now begins what is expected to be a multi-year process of public review and rulemaking. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
School Superintendent Carol Como presented her administration's proposed 2012-2013 budget to the Anchorage School Board yesterday morning. The district is bracing for a big budget shortfall, and the impact of proposed cuts will be deep. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
In her introduction Monday morning, Superintendent Carol Como described how large that shortfall between predicted revenues and existing programs is.
$29.5 million, but the board did authorize us to use $7 million in fund balance, so it got our budget gap down to $22.5 million, and that is what we have been working off of since that number was identified.
She says the shortfall stems from a variety of causes, such as inflation, increased labor, supply, and utility costs, but especially flat state funding support and Anchorage Assembly revenue restrictions. State revenues account for over 60% of the district's general funding. Local sources, primarily property taxes, approximately a third. The superintendent says the $22 million gap afflicts painful program changes and impacts classrooms.
Class sizes. We are recommending no change at the kindergarten through second grade level. In grade 3, we're recommending a 0.5% increase. Grades 4 through 8, we're talking about increasing by 1 across, and 1.5 in grades 9 through 12.
The administration wants to keep 81 classroom teachers originally funded through a federal jobs bill that runs out this year. Comal says that requires cutting other staff positions.
Because we're a people-intensive business, there are many position cuts, about 88 FTE.
The FTE, or full-time equivalency, translates into more than 88 positions because some are part-time. Program eliminations include high school graduation coaches, middle school career guides, and summer school.
We've said this repeatedly to the state and to the legislature. We are not funded for summer. We are not funded beyond the 180 days. And we believe that we need adequate funding within the school year first and foremost, and that's where we should be placing our major efforts.
Last year, the state legislature voted supplemental revenues beyond its basic funding. Comal says the district should not assume the same thing will happen again this year. And even if such funding appears, it would be after the district's budget must be approved. If extra funding arises, then the school board faces the task of deciding what to restore. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The local newspapers for the Bristol Bay and Unalaska region will be back next month. However, the two papers are being combined into one publication. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Jason Evans is the co-publisher of the papers, and he and his wife purchased the papers from Alaska Newspapers, which shut down 6 newspapers just last summer.
Yeah, it's going to be the combined paper, so it'll have the masthead of the Bristol Bay Times, the Dutch Harbor Fisherman. And as time goes on, we'll take a look at if we should separate them back out or if we should rename the paper altogether.
While the process to get the Bristol Bay Times and Dutch Harbor Fisherman back into print has been quite lengthy, Evans has continued publication of the other paper that he purchased from Alaska Newspapers, the Arctic Sounder. He confirms that the editor of the Arctic Sounder, Carrie Restino, will be the editor of the new combined Bristol Bay Times, Dutch Harbor Fisherman. Restino and the papers will be based out of Anchorage, and Evans says the plan is to publish the combined paper once a week.
We're looking at a Thursday publication date, and we're working with our Anchorage printer right now to determine if that will be the exact day.
Evans is hoping to have the first combined paper printed Thursday, February 2nd, and he anticipates the paper will average between 16 to 20 pages per issue. The cost will be $1, and Evans is hoping to be able to pump up the local content in the paper.
One of the things when we started printing the Arctic Sounder is we tried to bring a lot more local news and local photos, and we hope to do the same in the Bristol Bay region. We hope that we get a lot more community involvement and community photos.
The Bristol Bay Times and Dutch Harbor Fisherman were just 2 of the 6 newspapers serving rural areas of Alaska that Alaska Newspapers published. The parent corporation for Alaska Newspapers was the Chulista Corporation, which decided on July 22nd to shut down and liquidate the company. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Recent days have seen a surge in powerful solar flares. The sun's energized particles are now hitting the Earth's atmosphere and leading to disruptions in amateur radio communications and a boost in northern lights displays. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
Alaska is experiencing the largest solar radiation storm in nearly a decade. 2 solar explosions Sunday night sent a load of energy and particles towards the Earth's atmosphere.
The sun puts out an anomalous amount of X-rays pointing towards the Earth, and more importantly, the solar wind is at a much greater speed, much more energetic, which then causes impacts on the Earth's ionosphere and the upper atmosphere.
That's Carvin Scott, the chief of the Environmental and Scientific Services Division at the National Weather Service in Anchorage. The National Weather Service is calling it the largest solar radiation storm since October of 2003. The first particles from this storm began arriving early this morning. Carvin says there are reports of widespread disruptions to radio communication across the high-frequency bands. NOM's Marty Rood works with the Amateur Radio Emergency Services Organization. He says the storm has impacted his tests.
It wiped my ability to send digital email through my HF rig until about 12 noon, and even that one wasn't rock solid. So the durations are kind of short. They could be longer depending on the solar flare, but for the most part, as far as HF radio, it can knock you out for a day or so, and then you're able to communicate again on an average, I would say.
Satellites are also vulnerable to the high-power solar storms and can turn off temporarily to protect their circuitry. GCI says there have not been any impacts to their services from the storm. One of the most visible effects of the increased solar activity is the likelihood of enhanced northern lights displays. Scott says the strength of the storm should allow the aurora to be seen across a broader geographic area, down to portions of the lower 48. And while the best displays are typically in the very early morning hours, tonight's displays should be visible shortly after sundown.
I think that it'll be one of these cases where it could be visible most of the night into the twilight hours of Wednesday morning.
The Alaska Geophysical Institute has issued a forecast labeled extreme. They predict highly active auroral displays visible overhead from Barrow to Bethel, down to Dillingham and Ketchikan. Sky watchers also experienced above-average northern lights shows this weekend. Scott says the recent events are connected and occur as part of an 11-year solar cycle.
We are ramping up over the next year to year and a half to where what we think will be the peak of the solar cycle, which means that this sorts of occurrences should be more frequent, meaning that more what we call coronal mass ejections and solar radiation storms.
And that means residents of Alaska will experience all that comes with the increased activity.
Over the next couple of 2 to 3 years, we should be expecting impacts to our GPS, impacts to our high-frequency communication, and certainly something that's really nice is being able to have more vivid and enhanced auroras.
The space weather forecast is good for viewing the enhanced northern lights. Equally important, however, is the amount of cloud cover and your local weather forecast. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Aaron Selbig in Homer, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jocelyn Estes and Len Anderson in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Ben Matheson in Nome. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand. Bottom line, the benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.